Good afternoon. My name is Rachel Elbin, and as a member of the Clark Forum Student Board, I am pleased to welcome you to the board's first program at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues. On behalf of the Clark Forum and the Office of the Dean of Students, I would like to welcome you to this afternoon's program, Transgender Issues. Whether gender is interpreted as socially constructed or biologically determined, gendered roles, expectations, and identifications pervade social life. The seemingly fixed categories of gender maintained in the United States today do not allow for the exploration of identity beyond the binary of male and female. Such restrictive classifications foster a confusing and anxious cultural environment that castigates individuals whose identities the dualist categories seek to erase. People often traverse narrowly structured ideas of gender and sex. As dissenters of state gender definitions and understandings continue to speak out, however, a more open exploration of the intricate intersection between gender and sex increases in range of listeners and opportunities to achieve a more complex understanding. Julie Nemechek, Bear Bergman, and Professor Chris Talbot, three scholars within the field of gender studies, have joined us today for a discussion of these issues. Dr. Julie Nemechek, in addition to having served as pastor, consultant, and university professor, acts as a passionate spokesperson for the transgender cause. Bear Bergman is a three-time award-winning playwright, author, and performer who works at the points of intersection between gender, sexuality, and culture. Professor Chris Talbot, having received her doctorate in history and graduate certificate in women's studies from the University of Michigan, currently teaches courses in women's studies, the history of sexuality, and feminist theory at Dickinson College. Before we begin, I ask that the sound be disabled on any cell phones or pagers. In addition, please hold any questions until the end of the presentation, when there will be a question and answer session. Because today's event is being recorded, and out of courtesy to our guests who may be hearing impaired, please raise your hand and wait for a microphone to reach you before you pose your question. Following today's program, please join us for a buffet lunch in the lobby, and thank you for your cooperation. And at this time, I would also like to announce that at 7 this evening in the Great Room of the Stern Center, Julie Nemechek and Bear Bergman will share more of their stories and suggestions for overcoming gender barriers. And now, please join me in welcoming our guests.
I think I'll be here, mostly because I have paper. Thank you all for coming, and I want to thank the Clark Center for organizing this event, particularly Jolie and Heather for providing sort of the kind of logistical stuff, and for the students who sort of solicited me to participate, and especially to Bear and Julie for coming and providing such an exquisite context for sort of consciousness raising and discussing and discussion of transgender issues. I want to begin today by defining a number of terms that are central to our discussion today. I'm going to begin with a somewhat semantic distinction between sex and gender. As traditionally understood, sex is a biological category and gender is a socially constructed one. As I often tell my students, sex is what you have, gender is what it means to have what you have. I'm going to trouble that by the end of my conversation today, and hopefully it will be more troubled in your mind by the time you leave. But that's sort of where things are normatively understood. Normatively, people who inhabit female bodies become women. People who inhabit male bodies become men. And the term transgender is an umbrella term to describe a variety of non-normative ways people configure the relationship between sex bodies and the gendered persons they become. Underneath that category, the term transsexual is a term that describes people who live full-time as the gender not normatively associated with the sexed bodies, with the sexed body currently attached to them. They seek surgical correction to match their sexed bodies with their sense of them of their gendered selves. Transgenderist is also a term under the umbrella term transgender for people who live full-time as the sex opposite in which that way, in that which they were born, but with no desire or intention to surgically correct the body. Transsexuals and transgenderists come in two central varieties, female to male, for whom the correct pronoun is he and the correct sort of designation is man or trans man, and male to female, for whom the correct pronoun is she, who often are referred to as trans women. Now, there are also various proliferations of transgender expression that include cross-dressing, sometimes but not always presenting as a gender at variance from biological sex, butch femme identities performed among both women and men, and any number of adjectives that describe gendered experiences that can't be captured by the binaries of masculine and feminine: androgynous, ambigender, bigender, pangender, non-gender, fluid gender, intergender. Sometimes accompanied by a similar kind of pronoun proliferation. Now, transgender people and non-transgender people alike make choices about gender expression and performance in relationship to our sexed bodies, but we don't all make them in the same context. I want to zone in on one context that I think profoundly inflects the ways transgendered people experience and make choices about sex and gender, as well as how trans people are interpreted in larger social worlds. I want to look at what I'm calling the psychologization, which is a hard word to get out, and the medicalization of transgender phenomena. Now, I want to clarify, my point here is not really to question whether or not transgender identities are or are not psychological or medical conditions, but rather to think about the question what the implications of thinking about transgendered identities in psychological and medical terms are. The identification of transgender phenomenon has been predominantly understood as a psychological condition, if not a psychological disorder. The terms for that condition are alternately gender dysphoria and gender identity disorder. Moreover, medicalized and psychologized systems have historically understood a breadth of transgender phenomenon in narrower transsexual terms, for which the cure is to bring the sexed body in correspondence with gender identity through surgical and other interventions. I want to talk briefly about some of the medical options available and often encouraged under psychologized and medicalized rubrics. There is hormone replacement therapy, by which drugs are taken to inhibit the sexed body's production of its sexed hormones, and synthetic hormones are taken appropriate to the sex a person is becoming. Under hormone replacement therapy, bodies develop secondary sex characteristics of the sexed body appropriate to hormones that are being taken. The hormone replacement therapy is often accompanied by what medical and psychological establishment calls the real-world experience, in which transsexuals and transgenderists live a year under the gender role that they understand themselves to be. There's also available sex reassignment surgery, generally after that year is deemed by medical and psychological professionals as having been successful. Sex reassignment surgery often constitutes breast removal for trans men, phalloplasty for trans men, and the construction of vaginas for trans women. There are other surgical and therapeutic options, which sometimes include laser hair removal, voice therapy, sometimes surgery on vocal cords, various kinds of feminization, masculinization, surgeries on face, buttocks, hips, and so on. Now, I think these diagnoses and solutions work well for some people and less well for others. I think they do have a tendency to encourage the alteration of the body as a resolution to a broad variety of gender variants. That solution is certainly not one size fits all.
More to the point for me, though, I think the psychological and medical models of transgender phenomena put in place systems of regulation that survey and police transgender bodies in the interest of what they call a standard of care. Letters from psychologists are required to begin hormone replacement therapy, and to get such letters, transgender people are often required to prove to psychological professionals that they are indeed really a woman or really a man. The person who ultimately decides whether or not someone is really transgendered enough to warrant treatment and/or surgery is often not the person experiencing it. That degree of success, the degree of success in passing as the gender they experience themselves to be, is often then translated into eligibility and readiness criteria, allowing medical professions to determine if and when people receive treatment that may or may not include sex reassignment surgery. Now, I'm not entirely advocating a wholesale rejection of standards of care. Trans people, like the rest of us, deserve quality medical care. And in some ways, a standard of care might help reinforce that. I'm not sure, as it's currently configured, that it does. But I do think the psychologization and medicalization beg at least two sets of interrelated questions. First, how do standards of care work to manage and constrain the choices transgender people can make about their gender experience and performance? And to what extent do psychological and medical models place transgender bodies under systemic and sometimes public surveillance, opening the most intimate and personal of experiences and choices to medical and public scrutiny? Alongside these two questions, I also want to trouble the relationship between sex and gender with which I began, as I promised you I would. We tend to think as sex as though it is given, and gender as though it is socially constructed. I think the phenomenon of transgenderism requires us to at least consider Judith Butler's contention that, quote, perhaps this construct called sex is as culturally constructed as gender. Indeed, perhaps it always already was gender, with the consequence that the distinction between sex and gender turns out to be no distinction at all. Thank you.
Glad to be here. Thank you very much for having us. You'll find that as we talk that we come at a lot of the issues in different ways. I'm going to go through a 30-minute PowerPoint in less than 10 minutes, so hang on and we'll move quick. I think it'll help to get some things out there that are part of the discussion that is going on. I just want to say a word about my logo. My middle son designed that and I love it. So that's where it starts. The other thing I want to say is that this is adapted from a presentation by Randy Barnaby, who is a trans woman and one of the leading attorneys in the nation on trans issues and trans rights. The litigant in Smith v. Salem, which was a significant decision saying that gender expression and gender identity is protected under Title VII, the Civil Rights Law of 1964. All right, it's just some general terms, okay? Gender is typically talked about as the behavioral, cultural, or psychological traits typically associated with one sex. I think I missed one. Oh, well. Gender identity is a person's internal sense of who they are, feminine, masculine, male, female, boy, girl, man, woman. Gender identity is determined by a part of the brain, not by genitals. There's a lot of research that shows that part of the brain, part of our biology, helps define who we are as gender. In August of this year, the Chicago Tribune read an article about this whole subject saying that almost all scientists now agree that at least in part, sexual orientation and gender identity are biologically fed. Some of the most significant research has been on brain autopsies. I haven't volunteered for that research, but it shows that the part of the brain that in transsexual people that is assumed to identify gender is the same size in trans women as it is in genetic women, and vice versa for men. So that's an interesting hypothesis to look at, and it, the research shows that it doesn't depend on whether or not they've been on hormone replacement therapy. That doesn't seem to change that part of the brain. An interesting construct. I want to be very clear, I don't think we should be dependent on either a psychological or medical construct for gender identity. I think they can be helpful in informing us about who we are and how we can live in life, but I don't think we need to be dependent on that at all. Sexual orientation is simply who we're attracted to. This is a typical way of looking at gender dysphoria, which is another name for the nasty diagnosis of gender identity disorder. In DSM-IV, it's still listed as a disorder. I'm a psycho. This sheet that I handed out is an excerpted from a legal brief by Lambda Legal and the American Civil Liberties Union to help someone get the medical care they needed that was being denied them. And so it was important for them in that context to stress both the medical and psychological backgrounds for it so they could justify getting the care that someone who was in an incarcerated situation needed the medical care. In other contexts, you can get that medical care even without going to a doctor. I mean, you can buy hormones on the internet, which I do not recommend for anybody. If you are in hormone replacement therapy, it should be under a doctor's care if that's a decision that you make, whether or not a psychologist is a gatekeeper for you. The traditional understanding of human sexuality is somewhat like that. That guy was actually my mom's dentist, the model for that picture. It's Grant Woods, Cedar Rapids, Iowa. So I have some family connection to that ugly picture. The traditional view says when you come out of the womb, a doctor takes a little peek and says, yep, boy, yep, girl. And from that point on, you're pretty much defined by whatever the doctor says based on looking at your legs. And when that happens, your life goes on and you're expected to live, if you're announced as a male, with macho life. Your orientation is supposed to be to female. Your gender identity should be that as a boy or a man. Conversely, if you come out of the womb as a woman, announced so by the doctor, as a female, you're supposed to be feminine in your life. You're supposed to have sexual orientation to male. And you are supposed to live as a girl or woman. That's a binary kind of view of gender identity. The moment of birth essentially is a fork in a road where everything is determined for you by whatever the doctor says. A modern approach pretty much X out all of those characteristics and looks at a continuum for all of these things. For example, each category is defined as this continuum, neutral being somewhat in the middle. Here is a male who is heterosexual, moderate masculinity, strongly sexually oriented towards women with a moderate to strong male gender identity. Here's a woman with a moderately to strong sexual orientation, but only with a minimal female gender identity. We might call someone like that, or someone might call someone like that, a tomboy. You've heard that expression. Now, when the characteristics fall on one side of a very narrow social construct, there's not too much problem. But as that construct expands, you can see that people that are even on the edges all of a sudden become marginalized. And even more so in some very, very conservative environments, everybody but the extremes is seen as somehow abnormal, sometimes somehow out of the realm of failing to conform to what society expects. Certain religious groups, certainly the military, would be examples of this kind of rigidity as it relates to gender. Here's a transsexual woman, male to female. And we've left out the middle part because it really is irrelevant. Okay, that person's gender identity is in conflict with their birth designation by the doctor. Now, part of what Chris said, I think, is an important thing to recognize, that maybe we define sex too narrowly, and that's what causes the conflict, that as a society we need to perhaps move away from that. But as society looks at things now, they see this as a major conflict. Your head says you're a woman and your body says you're a man. I'm going to talk more about my own personal experience tonight, but I have a 6-year-old grandson who I am no longer allowed to see since I've transitioned, But when I was able to do so, that child was sitting in my lap. We're very, very close. He likes to sit in my lap when we watch TV. And his parents had talked to him a little bit about what I was dealing with. He grabbed my head between his hands and looked at me, you know, eye to eye, about 4 inches apart, and said, "Grandpa," because that's how he was presenting at the time, "Grandpa, don't listen to your mind. You're a man, not a woman." It was touching. He was trying to fix it, you know, trying to make it go away. And I responded, "No, my mind tells me that I'm a woman, and I have to live that way." And that was all he needed to hear, and he was fine. Not all of society reacts so easily, as his parents, for example. Research shows that gender identity is unalterable, that our sense of gender is pretty much deeply ingrained in who we are. And here's where some of the medical and psychological kind of things come into play. Messing with our psychology, who we are, who we think we are, our sense of self, messing with our biology becomes very difficult. And so when we think about changing, science and psychology stress that, well, since you can't change your mind, your sense of identity about who you are, let's work at changing the body. I am not an absolutist when it comes to gender expression, and I think Chris was right on target when she said there's varying degrees, varying levels. I am very, very glad I went on hormone replacement therapy, would not hesitate to do it again. It was as if my body had been craving those all my life. My primary care physician said, based on his understanding, that that was a good confirmation that of the diagnosis that I had had, which is gender identity disorder in a very severe sense. I don't like the label gender identity disorder. I would prefer talking about gender identity as a medical condition. And I like keeping that label because that allows me to continue to get my insurance to pay for hormones, which is a nice thing to have. Ironically, the university I was fired from, their medical insurance did cover my hormones, so that was kind of cool, really. But I don't think surgery is a necessary option. And that's one of the things that those that followed Harry Benjamin, not Harry Benjamin himself, but those that followed Harry Benjamin kind of said, well, you aren't really a transsexual unless you have surgery. Susan Stanton has been in the news, the fired city manager from Largo, Florida, was on Larry King. And Larry King says, so did you have the surgery? And Susan said, no. And then Larry says, well, then you're just a cross-dresser, aren't you? And Susan said, no, and tried to explain that. I'm not sure if Larry was playing the devil's advocate or if he really didn't understand. But surgery isn't what defines us. Our minds does. What we do is put our body in connection with our minds as much as we feel necessary to live in society. I'll talk more about that this evening. Maybe I'll say a little bit about it when I get to the last slide. The only way for the transsexual man to reconcile the difference is through physical transition from female to male, as vice versa, in terms of how society looks at it. There are many people that stop at points along the way, and I want to recognize that very clearly, that, you know, there's a danger for even transgender people to get stuck in a binary model that says, well, I have to be a man or a woman. I still have some, you know, very strong masculine kind of interests in terms of some sports. I love to golf. You know, is that masculine? I don't think so. I think there's some women golfers that could kick most of the guys' butts in here. So it isn't, you know, how we construct it is a big issue. That slide there defines me. My physical sex, I was born, there's a male on my driver's license and there's still a male on my passport. My gender expression is very feminine. That's what I relate to. My sexual orientation is to Joanne, my wife of 35 years, and she has stayed with me. My gender identity as I would identify as a woman. A trans woman was the title probably that I would prefer. So that's kind of a discussion of where I am. One of the questions that always comes up that I'll answer now is, are you going to have surgery? You know, and that's because we're still stuck in some of the medical, psychological, legal kind of thinking. And the reason I place a lot of emphasis on that still is I'm very much committed to dealing with legal issues and very much committed to dealing with civil rights issues. If you have not yet contacted your congressman and told them to support ENDA, please do so. And ENDA 2015, the end of it includes gender identity and gender expression. The other end is don't include that and really are a waste of time even for the GLB community. I'll give you an example of why they're a waste of time. Recently, a woman was kicked out of a women's restroom. This is a genetic woman, because she looked too butch. They didn't want her in the restroom. Now, she wasn't kicked out because she was lesbian, which in this case it happened she was. She was kicked out because she looked too butch. So ENDA, as it's currently being advocated by Barney Frank and not all the civil rights groups in the country except for the Human Rights Campaign, is an ENDA that will not protect gay and lesbian people unless they confine themselves to a very binary model of expression. If you're a man, you got to look like a man. If you're a woman, you got to look like a man, a woman. And so it's a very confusing kind of thing. Surgery. I am not going to have surgery at this point, and the reason is Joanne and I are going to stay together. If I was divorced and looking to be romantically involved elsewhere, surgery would be important to me. It isn't. She still likes the part of my anatomy that doesn't do much anymore. But for that reason, we made that decision together. It's a private decision. It's an important decision. But it's not one that defines who I am. I have no problem saying I'm a transsexual. Probably the best way that illustrated that for me and helped me with self-discovery was I attended Southern Comfort some years ago for the first time. It's the largest gathering of trans people in the world on an annual basis. There were about 1,000 there this last September. Trans people, allies, people that work with trans people. And I have a friend who would be defined on that continuum as more of a cross-dresser than a transsexual. And I was at the point in my life where I was really in discovery. I knew I had a gender identity issue. And a gender identity disorder was written in a letter to the university by my therapist to help the university possibly consider keeping me employed. It didn't work. But at the end of those 5 days when we both had to slip back into male mode because I hadn't transitioned yet, my friend said, "Whew, that's enough of that for a while." And for me, it was like a prisoner going back to prison after a weekend passed. And it was at that point that I knew that transition was inevitable for me. And I was going to do it no matter what the medical models or others said. And I do want to say that, you know, I agree with a lot of what, you know, Bear and I are going to disagree on some things. And you're going to hear that. But I think a big part of what Bear has to say, I would agree with 100%. It should be an individual's choice. Ultimately, what it's about is authenticity. Being able to live as who you are. And once I was able to do that, my life changed radically. I could wake up in the morning with a smile on my face. I could hear music in a way that I never heard it before. Smells and sights and sounds all of a sudden took on a life of their own. Would I do it again? In a heartbeat.
Losing things off the side here. Good morning. Oh, well, actually, I guess it's afternoon, isn't it? Good afternoon. Isn't it strange how good afternoon just does not roll off the tongue in the same way that good morning does? Well, we've been... Say that again.
It's kind of frustrating.
Well, you know, we've been having terms and definitions already for 20 minutes, so I figured I'd just point that out. You know, we have these little inconsistencies of language. I am not going to define any terms for you right now. I also have no charts and no graphs, about which I can tell you are all very disappointed, for which I apologize. Chris and Julie are both academics, and they are very good and thoughtful about what they do. I'm a performer and a writer and a storyteller, so I tell stories and ask questions. There's that old thing about how a storyteller with no audience is just a guy talking to himself. So I'm going to ask you when I ask questions or ask you to raise your hand for things to, you know, respond and behave as though I am not actually talking to myself helps me feel better about the whole many-angled thing. The first story I want to tell you is from this past summer. My grandfather just died in July, about 3 days short of his 90th birthday, and he was great. And he and I were very close. About 2 weeks before he died, I went down to Baltimore, where he and my grandmother lived, to spend some time with them, say goodbye to him, and take care of her. You know, take her to lunch and shopping and get her out a little bit. And there was a place in the hospital where my grandfather was where there were quilts hanging on the walls. And he really liked them. His hospital room was like hospital rooms are. It's boring. There's nothing to look at. He never much liked television. So in the afternoons, I would load him into his wheelchair, and we would roll out to the place where the quilts were. We would usually sit there for an hour or two just looking at the quilts and holding hands. And every day when we would sit there, you know, and I'm this big guy in shorts and t-shirt, right, trying not to cry, so I'm a little sniffly and my eyes are red, but I'm determined I am not going to cry in front of my grandfather because he's dying. It's not like he needs me to worry about. And we're holding hands because he just wanted me to be near. He could hardly see at that point. He couldn't really talk. And every afternoon, nurses and nurses' assistants, most of whom were women, would walk by and take a look at us and give me this very particular smile. Very warm, a little surprised. And I wonder how that smile would have been different if they had known that I was born female. Last spring, I was on an airport shuttle jitney bus thing. Where was I? I don't know. Chicago, maybe? I was going to get my rental car. It was one of those little things that comes around. You know the thing I mean. Don't laugh at me. Come on. And I was the only one on the shuttle. And the driver looks at me, and he opens his mouth to say something, and then instead he says, "Oh, you have two earrings." Yes. Because what do you say, really? Well spotted, sir. Is it now time for my job? I mean, and the guy's like, I don't know, probably 75 years old. It's his second career. He's this, you know, much older white guy wearing sweatpants. I'm trying to figure out if it's time for my, like, fashion consult now. And he says, "Well, normally when I see guys with one earring, I say, 'Where's the other one?' But you have two." Yes. Yes, I do. Because what do you say? And then a minute passes and he says, "You know, it kind of makes you look like a fat." And I wonder how that conversation would have been different if he had known that I was born female. On the drive here, don't fire the guy. He's cool. But on the drive here, I got picked up at the airport, you know, in a car, because apparently I'm now important enough that that happens, which I frankly had no idea. And, you know, normally it's the jitney with Phil, who wants to talk to me about my jewelry. But last night it was, you know, Bob, and he's cool. But, so we've got this, you know, ride together in the car, and I like to talk to people, and I'm a storyteller, so I like to hear their stories. So I say to him, "Who's the most annoying passenger you've ever had?" And he knows right away. "There was this woman from New York," he tells me, "and she was such a bitch, like you have no idea. Nothing was right. Everything had to be exactly the way she wanted it. She didn't like this thing, and she didn't like that thing, and oh my God, you have never met such a bitch in your whole life." Okay. And I'm thinking, first of all, you've never met my Aunt Toots. So then I ask him, who's his favorite passenger been? Because these are the kind of questions that you ask when you're, you know, in a car with somebody you don't know regularly for long periods of time. You develop a repertoire. So I ask him, who is his favorite passenger? Oh, he says, there was this guy who was speaking out at the War College. He owned a construction crew and this, that, and the other thing, and something about beer and something about sports, and I tuned out a little bit for a minute. And then we got back to the original part of the conversation. He says, and they had to drive out onto the point of the thing was they had to drive out onto the tarmac to the plane, to this guy's private plane, because he had a trunk full of beer, Yuengling beer, that he'd never had before. So they get up to the plane, and the driver says, and I get up there, and the pilot and the captain and the co-pilot come out, and what do you think? They are a couple of hot chicks. I guess if you have that kind of money, you can just have whatever you want. And I wonder how this conversation would have been different if he had known that I was born female. This morning, at 9:15... I had just woken up. I got in about 2 o'clock in the morning from Denver. I was at Colorado State this beginning of this week. It's 9:15 in the morning. I am naked in bed, which is perhaps an image that you didn't need to indulge in, but bear with me here. It's all right. Most of you aren't really that cute either. You laughed when I said it. You got to take it back. Don't even look at me up there. Besides, you've been text messaging half the time. I don't want to hear it. Anyway, that's not the point of the story. The point of the story is, so there I am, and I have just woken up, you know, my festive gay hair in disarray. I'm still in bed, and I have just gotten myself up and out of bed, and the door bangs open. It's housekeeping. Now, normally they knock, or at least that's been my experience up till now. And, you know, usually if they knock and you're in there, you say, excuse me, or good morning, or hey, cut that out, or whatever you say. And somebody will, you know, retreat immediately. They don't come in. They definitely don't come in. And she stood there in the doorway staring at my transsexual body for what had to be 30 seconds. You know how long 30 seconds is when you're naked? Who's got a stopwatch? Who's got a stopwatch?
No.
Give me 30 seconds.
No.
That's 10. At about 20, I say...
That was about 20.
Shut the door. Oh, she says. And moves her. And that's when I realize that she's actually holding it open with her foot. And she moves it. And slowly, in the way of, you know, nice hotels where they don't want the door to bang, it starts to close. I don't really wonder what that moment would have been like if she had realized that I was born female. I think we were clear there. Or we were clear on something. It was clear to her that there was something not right going on. I don't think she understood exactly what she was looking at, but whatever it is, I'm pretty sure she could draw a police sketch now. Say that again. Well, I assume she was looking at my handsome face. So you all knew that this was a forum on transgender issues, right? How long do I have? Good on time?
Yeah.
Okay. Raise your hand. Okay. And be honest, because really, it's okay. I know I'm your show-and-tell tranny. It's cool. Raise your hand if when you walked in here and looked at Julie and I, you started looking for what seemed to you like signs that we were not always the sex that we are now. Put your hand, you know, keep your hands up. Oh, actually, okay, go ahead. Put your hands up all, because it's not fair. Put your hands up all afresh if you're still trying to figure out whether or not I have a dick. No one's wondering that. The first one honest guy in the back of the room is trying to figure it out. The only group of college students in the history of the world who, or maybe you're not wondering because you already heard the housekeeper story. And so you think that must have been what she was trying to figure out. All right, here's my question. Well, here's my next question. What's a dick for? What do you use it for?
Sex.
Sex? Peeing. Come on, people. What?
Reproduction.
For entertainment purposes only. I think actually we're going to characterize that one under sex, because I am of the opinion that it's sex whether you're alone or with other person or people, if that's how you roll. So, sex, peeing, reproduction. Oh dear. Well, okay, what I'm going to say, I think that's a brave answer, actually. And what I'm going to say is, I think sometimes it gets used that way, but I'm not sure I would say that's what it's for. I think what it's actually for, you know, what you do with it, as opposed to what it means to you, is you have sex, you pee, and you make babies. Can you still be a man if you can't make babies? Are we sure? Okay. Can you pee without a dick? Can you have sex without a dick?
Yes.
All right, gentlemen of Dickinson College, here's where things get real. Can you have sex without a dick even if you have one? All the girls say yes, and all the guys are like, well, I guess you could, though I'm not really sure why you'd want to. So if all of those things are true, do I need a dick to be a man? Whether I have one or not, which is a whole separate question. Just checking. I'm going to be the gentleman here and pour everyone more water while we get set for questions. This is your display of gender roles, don't mind me. Though I guess you could really make a case that it would be equally a display of gender roles if Julie did it, because then she would be serving everyone water. God, gender's complicated.
All right, thank you. We'll open it up to questions.
Thank you to both of you for being so vulnerable and so open with all of us. It's difficult to be honest with people you know. So to walk into a room full of weirdos like us has got to be a challenge sometimes. Did want to raise a point, or a question rather. Julie said a lot about, actually Chris and Julie both, about defining sex and gender in terms of society versus what we quote-unquote know about ourselves. And Julie, something you said raised the question in my mind. Your physical choices regarding surgery are based on your relationship with someone else, which we might call a sort of micro-society.
Only in part.
Only in part, yeah. But I guess the dot, dot, dot after that then becomes, so how do, I guess you probably could only answer for you, but how do your impression of society's beliefs or of our family's beliefs or of the people that are close to us change what we think about ourselves and vice versa? You know what you may have discovered this is a complicated subject to talk about.
Yeah, if I understand what you're...
Did you turn your...
I think it's on, isn't it?
Okay.
I think if I understand what you're asking, you know, how does society change how we see ourselves and how does it impact decisions we make, like... whether or not to be pre-op, post-op, or non-op. I would consider myself non-op at this point, but maybe pre-op, because Joanne and I are both clear that this is the decision we've made for now. But I think Bear's point is a good one, you know, that with or without a penis, you know, doesn't make much difference in terms of how your head sees who you are. Yes, society makes a big, has a big impact on us. And one of the things I'm going to talk about tonight is that when we transition, people that stay with us transition too, because they have to go through a whole paradigm shift in terms of reality. And part of it is they go through a grief process. They grieve the loss of the person they thought you were before they can celebrate, often before they can celebrate the person they find out that you are. One of the delightful things that I've heard in the whole process is from Joanne, my partner, 35 years. She says she has back now the person that dated her. Which describes a little bit of the emotional shutdown, the energy that's needed to live a lie. And, you know, we're more in love now than we've ever been, and it's kind of cool. You know, it's kind of fun. It's different. People scratch their heads about it. Her parents won't, or not her parents, her father won't talk to her, never wants to see me again. My dad had been married for 58 years. My dad tells people I'm his daughter from his first marriage. People go through a transition process, and you do too. You know, I've had to change a lot of my views. As a minister, I never preached anti-gay or lesbian or transgender messages, but I have become much more of a vocal proponent of understanding the rich diversity of God's creation and honoring that. Celebrating diversity is a big part of what my consulting work is all about. Hope that answered your question. Okay, good. Remember, that's not my work. But go ahead.
I was just curious about the female-sized thing. So that's saying that females have a smaller area of the brain for sex than males. Is that what that's saying?
For that part of the brain, yes. For other parts of the brain, females have larger part. But the part that defines gender identity is apparently differently sized. The other research that they've done most recently is brainwave research, and they've done that with transgender people as well. And the self-identity that transgender people have about male or female often shows up with brainwave activity that parallels more traditional or genetic female and male roles. So there is medical research. Bottom line, if all the research were proven false, would it make any difference to how I choose to live? The answer is no. So why is the research important? Because for many people, it helps them get past the idea that you're choosing to live some kind of perverted life, and helps them understand that there's reasons innate to your being about why you need to express yourself the way you're doing it. So that's why I find it helpful. The psychological model, I'm not sure, is as helpful as the medical or / biological. But I'm not married to either one. Does that help? Okay.
I'm gonna tag on to that question just a little bit. Because one of the things that for me becomes important when looking at medical research about trans folks and psychological research about trans folks, as Chris said, there's been a strong medicalization. And I think part of that is exactly as Julie said about, you know, it's sort of a cousin to the I'm queer because I was born that way and so therefore it's normal and natural and so you must accept me. What I wonder about is who here sort of has the experience or feels like transsexuals are kind of a new thing? Like all of a sudden there's transsexuals everywhere. I see a lot of people who are like this. Like, is that okay?
It's all lies.
Jerry Springer, when I was in the, you know, when I was sick in high school, sometimes there would be some strange-looking characters, I don't know.
Renee Richards.
Have any of you ever heard the words Hihira? Katui? Timtum? Androgynos? Huame? Aliha? Would anyone be surprised to know that all of those words describe trans people, and the youngest of them is about 2,500 years old? So while I appreciate the fact that people are busily studying brainwaves, because that's interesting, and why wouldn't you? I don't feel like it gives us any real information about whether or not transsexuals or transgendered folks are authentic or legitimate. We have always existed since, you know, the beginning of recorded history in every culture that has a recorded history. I saw a lot of hands. I don't want to go on. I could go on about that particular subject all day. I won't, but I could. No, you have to, because it has to get caught on the recording. Sorry.
It goes into your student file.
Your permanent record.
Okay, Julie, this question is for you, or anyone who wants to answer. But you had mentioned that your partner enjoys the anatomically male part of you that you said no longer really works.
Not as well as it used to. Yeah.
As well. I'm wondering, do you feel like you're personally able to have a fulfilling sex life in spite of that?
Yeah, that's a question we often get. And the way we make sex, have love, show our love for each other physically has had to change. Joanne doesn't like being called a lesbian, and that was one of the most difficult things for her to deal with, is that people would see us in a lesbian relationship. And she says, I love the person. I don't care what the label is. I would identify myself as a lesbian because the person I make love to is a woman, and I'm a woman. The way we've made love is different, and we've learned to enjoy that and express ourselves in it. Part of what happens with hormone replacement therapy for male to female is the sex drive diminishes significantly. And so one of the things that's happened in our relationship is that we've had to be more vocal and open about which one of us is feeling the need at the time. And we were speaking in Eastern Michigan University, and a student asked that question to Joanne, and she answered it pretty much how I did, except she ended with saying, when I want it, Julie responds, which answered exactly what the student was asking. So, and that's just the way our relationship is. You know, we both are very comfortable with our sexuality as it's evolved. Good question. I'm sure other people were thinking it.
Thank you. I was wondering how you guys feel about, and any one of you could answer this question, how you feel about the idea that in this country, if I want to, I can go out and smoke 10 packs of cigarettes a day. I can do anything I want to my body. If I have the means, I can get any sort of plastic surgery that I want to alter my appearance. I can have any of that done. But how do you feel about the idea that for you, somebody is telling you need to see a psychologist or a psychiatrist or a therapist? Like, do you find that inherently unfair? Or is there some sort of value in behind that that I can't see? Thanks.
Good question.
No, I think you're 100% right. It makes me batshit. And I think you're 100% right. That is the exact... You have clearly and articulately stated the exact argument that many people have about the way that trans folks are obliged to seek medical care. And I think it's a credit both to you and to the education you're getting at Dickinson that you're able to see that particular problem so clearly.
I think one of the things I'd say about that is that the reality is that many trans people know, or at least think they want medical care, can't afford it, don't want to go through the hoops, but still get it. And they get, you can go on the internet right now, today, order hormones that'll come directly to your door.
Do not try this at home.
Absolutely not.
Okay.
I did. It was very stupid, and I did it for a short time. And my reason was I didn't want the university to know, because I didn't trust HIPAA and all the privacy stuff. I didn't want the university to know that my doctor was prescribing them. The medical care that's necessary when you go on hormones is significant. I get about $1,000 worth of blood work every 4 months now. It's going to shift to 6 months because nothing bad has shown up and a lot of good stuff has shown up in terms of the way it's working, how I get supposed to work. But you can, on the internet, you can get drugs that are polluted, corrupted, not what you think they are. And it's just simply not a smart thing to do. People getting surgery will go to Montreal or they'll go to Thailand because they don't want to go through all the hoops that are necessary in this country. And in both of those places, you can get around some of the standards that the American Medical Association restricts its surgeons to currently. The medical model, most trans people know what they need, and don't want to wait 1 or 2 or 3 years for it. If you talk about two years of hormones plus, well, let's back it up. If you talk about 6 months to a year of counseling, then 2 years of hormones, then 1 year of a real life experience, you're talking about 4 or 5 years of your life to get to who you are, to be able to express who you are as you want to express it. And the gatekeeping is horrendous and it's unnecessary. I went to a therapist because I wanted to make sure that what I thought was me, and the therapist confirmed it. I went to an endocrinologist because my therapist recommended it and said there are other things that can cause those feelings. Let's make sure it's not one of those. There's some chemical imbalances that can cause those feelings, and it wasn't one of those. And so the endocrinologist kind of confirmed the diagnosis. And so I had two people that were familiar with working with trans people who weren't going to be stuck by following the standards that their communities call them to follow. And I was very fortunate, and I'm aware of that.
Thank you.
On behalf of the Clark Forum, I would like to present all of you with a token of our appreciation for participating in this event.
In my secret heart, I was really hoping they were going to give me a school tie and Julia's school scarf. Yeah.
And now please join me in thanking Julie Nemechek, Bear Bergman, and Professor Chris Talbot. This concludes our presentation, but I'd like to remind everyone that at 7 tonight in the great room of the Stern Center, Julie Nemechek and Bear Bergman will continue the discussion. And thank you all for attending. Okay.